Kelly Krager, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. John DeLong. Today is 30 March 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University. Mr. DeLong is joining me by phone from Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. Mr. DeLong, to begin this interview, I'd like to find out a little bit about your background. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born on March 12, 1942, in Louisville, Kentucky. At that time, my father was a lieutenant in the 1st Armored Division at Fort Knox. He was actually ROTC and was in the service prior to Pearl Harbor Day. And he and Mom had never owned a car. They were married in 1940. So they bought the 1941 Plymouth when he went in the service, a little trailer. And she lived off post, and she was pregnant with me. And so actually, I was born in Kentucky. My dad was there, and I spent most of the war years in the back seat of a 41 Plymouth or in that trailer, because she followed him everywhere he went. And I was told I traversed across the country back and forth at least three times before he shipped out from, believe it or not, he shipped out from California to England and then was part of the Normandy invasion.
Isn't that interesting? What were your parents' names?
My father is Arthur Frederick DeLong, and my mother is Pauline E. DeLong. They were two remarkable people.
Tell me about these two folks. Tell me about your mom and your dad, even prior to the war years.
Dad was Dad's a rock. He was we're Pennsylvania Dutch. I'm Pennsylvania Dutch, which is German. And he married my mother, who was Hungarian. Her mom and dad had gotten over here before World War One, and they were not rich people. And they met on bicycles. Dad was a renowned cyclist. 1930s, and Mom rode, and they met on the bike, and Dad had gone to Europe, actually went through Germany right before the war. He was a brazen guy, too, and on his way back, he ordered a tandem, bicycle built for two, and that was his way of announcing his engagement to my mom. Went from a single to the back seat of a tandem. And Dad was went to Europe in November of 43. He was billeted up in Wales. I'm pretty sure of that because I have a picture of him in a and on the back of the little picture, it gives the location of the photo shop that he went to get his picture taken. And this place called Pontypridd, and I actually looked up, Googled it, whatever it is, in Wales. He was an ordnance officer like I am, and there's a lot of father like son in this interview, or will be. And then he went in Normandy about 5 or 6 days after the first landings. And went all the way up through the Cotentin Peninsula up into Cherbourg. And then when he came home, he was changed. Now, not that I remember, but I do remember that he never spoke to me about it. He never opened up, except a few times. Once on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, I thought we could actually have a conversation, and it lasted no more than about 5 minutes, and he got up and walked out. Mom wouldn't talk about it either, but he left me quite a few artifacts, and probably the best one was after the war, they put out the Army put out a booklet on the invasion and those who went up towards Cherbourg, and he had obtained this, and in there he wrote different things which I thought were kind of neat. Dates, objectives, what they were doing, And then I thought one of his telling ones was in there. It says, according to the historical record, Cherbourg was secured on such and such a date. And underneath, he wrote, no, it wasn't. And he was there. And let's see, it was the 61st anniversary of D-Day. I went back with a group called Valor Tours.
Mm-hmm.
And our tour guide was a veteran. He was in the RAF. And we had two other veterans with us. It was a very focused history tour. And I was able to follow his footsteps from his photographs, because he carried a little Leica camera, which he wasn't supposed to, but he did. And he took a lot of pictures of churches and things like that, because his father's business was interior church architecture.
Hmm.
The Long Furniture Company, which is mostly interior church work. And so I was able to actually walk down places he walked. That gets to you.
Yeah, I bet it does.
And then I was able, I knew he was, I had a picture of him at Stonehenge.
Hmm.
And all it said was winter 1944. And when we went back, our tour started in London, because that's where the planning took place. And then I went back, and we spent 3 days in London, and took a tour bus out to Stonehenge. And I was able to take it and take his picture and slide it so I could almost stand in the same place.
Hmm.
There's only 2 days a year you can go up to Stonehenge to the, actually go up and actually right there. They have a ring around, of course, it's a World Historical Site.
Sure.
And I lined it up, and he stood where he stood.
Hmm. That must have been really powerful for you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Not only that, but having the three veterans that were there, mm-hmm. Being part of our little group of 17. I think it was 17 on the trip. So it was a real insight. I could talk for hours on what we saw, but that's not the purpose of this.
Yeah, well, that's still really cool, though. What did
the type of people they were when he came back? They couldn't afford a house, and so what they did is they bought a pretty large parcel of ground. But ground at that time was $125 an acre. And Mom had saved everything. I mean, they talk about saving pennies. Mom accounted for every cent. And I know that because I have some of Dad's canceled paychecks, and she accounts for every single penny in the paycheck. And so he would go to work, and then they built a one-room cabin, concrete slab. They bought a used deuce and a half, 2.5 ton, and a 3/4 ton truck. And then she would go down to Philadelphia, down to Fairmont, where there was an army base during the war, a training base, and they were tearing it down. So she went down, salvaged the wood, hauled it home in the deuce and a half, and they built a one-room cabin. And we lived in the cabin for over 3 years. The goats were on the other end with a flapper door to go in and out.
Hmm.
And there's no running water. There was a GI coal stove and a hot plate, electricity. And we lived in there when they built their own home.
Oh, that's fascinating.
So when I say they don't make them like that anymore, they do not.
I guess not. Where was this cabin? Where was this land?
Yeah, I'm still on it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I haven't gone far.
Oh, that's great.
I'm still living on the same ground, although the ground that I bought, where I bought my lot, I bought it from my grandfather because they couldn't afford to keep the 45 acres. And so they sold about half off to my grandfather, the Hungarian side. And then I found this out many, many years later when I was going through deeds, that when I was in Vietnam in 1967, she had on one of the deeds written to my grandfather, please save a parcel for your son. That's how she wrote it. I know nothing about this. I was never told. And then I knew I wanted to come back. I was just, my roots are here. And so I approached my grandfather, and he sold me a parcel of land, which he had saved. And then when Mom and Dad passed away, I inherited, although I paid hellish estate taxes, because this is back in the 90s, to maintain that parcel of land where it actually grown up.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't gone far. I'm on the same street now since 1947.
There's a lot to be said for that, I think.
Yeah.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
No. Right. Mom was not, she had an RH factor, and I'm the first, and that was the survivor. The others did not.
Okay. But tell me about growing up. In addition to obviously living in a cabin here, what did your folks do for a living, and what was life like for you growing up there in Pennsylvania?
Fantastic. Now, we lived in that until about 1950 and moved into the house. It was not finished, but it was livable. And Dad was in everything. He was in the Boy Scouts. He was a scoutmaster. It was constant involvement. Plus, there was the farm. And we had goats, ducks, geese, chickens. I think about, I was qualified on the big formal age 12 by about 11 or 12. And to put that in perspective, at 11 or 12, I'm on a tractor, which the wheels are actually as high as I am, tall, with a 7-foot sickle bar. And so Dad pushed you. I didn't realize it, but Dad pushed you. And I remember going out on hike, you know, when you get your hiking merit badge and so forth like that. And looking back, all of those men were World War II veterans. And they were always up front, and your tongue's hanging out trying to keep up. And, I mean, it was a great life. He let me a lot of, he gave me a lot of rope, but somehow he knew when to pull it in. Sometimes I think he gave me too much, and looking back, but I'll tell you one story, that I always liked the, I like cars. I like wheels. Still do. And so one day before I came home, and I was, you know, supposed to take the tractor out and do some mowing. And the wheels used to, you could move the wheels in and out on a spline shaft. And there was a large, long driveway around the house. It was actually a circle. And so I thought I'd do a couple laps around that before I went out and did the mowing. And the spline shaft stuck out about 8 or 9 inches past the wheel.
Uh-oh.
And I clipped the tree. And I broke the tractor in half.
Oh, wow.
It didn't come down, but I broke, it's cast iron, you know, the transmission, all that mechanism back there. I actually split it. And I got down off the thing and I looked at it, and I could see its lifeblood was all leaking out. Walked down the field. Mom was down there. And the understatement of the year was, Mom, I think there's something wrong with the tractor. And her response was, don't worry, Dad will fix it when he gets home. Well, that was what I was worried about. And it was pretty obvious what I had done. You could see the gouge on the tree. And he never raised his voice. All he said to me was, we'll fix it. And we did, right in the spot. There was no weekends for 3 or 4 weeks. But I remember it, jacked it up in spot and fixed it right there. So for him, it was a learning lesson.
Yeah.
Or a teaching lesson. No, the voice never raised. God, I wish I was as good as him. But it was a wonderful life, yeah.
Tell me about school. In addition to the things you were doing there at home and Boy Scouts and things, where did you go to school and how did you do?
I went to Jenkintown High School. It's a small, it's a public school, but in a small, very small community. We only had 52 in our senior class. I'm still in touch with a number of people in that class, even to this day. How many years later is that? We're still friends. The education was superb. It's what allowed me to go into college. Played football, ran track a little bit, and it was just a great. The 50s under Eisenhower. You couldn't ask for a better time to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was the day of Ozzie and Harriet. Father knows best. We've lost that, and it's a shame. But that's what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to college. ROTC was encouraged, let me put it that way, for a number of reasons. Number one was money, so you got a little step in, as I remember, and it was also family tradition. And I just kind of got that sense that, you know, Dad wanted me to do that.
Yeah.
And so I did.
Well, let me ask you, before we get you into ROTC, you mentioned Eisenhower talking about the 1950s. What do you remember, if anything, about what was going on in the world at the time, with the Soviet Union and the Korean War and Sputnik and, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis, all these different things going on in the 50s and 60s. What do you remember about that time?
We lived a very carefree life. High school was fun. It was Friday night football games, a sock hop afterwards. Drugs were unheard of, and even alcohol. And I remember, you know, the first time I had a beer was the night I graduated, and somebody had a house party, and there was beer and so forth. And I left because I didn't want to screw up my life. That sounds ridiculous today, but one of Mom's great teaching points was one time I got in late, and it wasn't my fault. Yeah, it was my fault, but it wasn't because I was doing anything bad. It was because the other guy was kissing in the back seat, making out, and he just didn't want to be dropped off, and so I got in late because I was driving around. And so I walked in the house. It was dark. Next morning, I walked downstairs, and there was silence from both of them. And I knew, you knew that you crossed the line. And I was asked what happened. And of course, I can't really come out and quite say what was happening. And so Mom turned around, and she was at the kitchen, and she pointed her finger at me. And she said, "You are my son. I expect you to behave as my son." That's all it took. That carried me through a lot of places when you could have made a bad decision.
When you finished high school, what did you hope to do? Any plans?
Yeah, I knew I was going to college.
Was that something your parents were pushing, or was it something that you wanted on your own, or both?
No, that was Dad.
Yeah.
Dad all the way. There was two different concepts, and both of them have stuck with me and been very helpful in life. Dad was a mechanical engineer. He was a brilliant mechanical engineer, and those are the words of his peers when he passed away. And he never stopped working. He finished out the last week at 79. He was gone by Sunday morning, but he finished the week. Mom said, "If you can work with your hands, you'll never be out of a job."
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I was around people that built their own home. I was around Dad, who went to work as a mechanical engineer and came home and put the tool belt on and built a house. And he taught me everything. He taught me carpentry. He taught me roofing. He taught me all those skills because you were there. You were expected to be part of this family. And those attributes have served me quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Mom was a homemaker. There was always food on the table. I don't know where it came from. It just appeared. The house was warm, cozy. The friends came over. Food appeared. It was, you know, it was just magical. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
College, I went off to college. I picked mechanical engineering. At that time, we didn't have guidance counselors and so forth,
mm-hmm.
but we also didn't have that. There's so many jobs out there that you don't know about when you're a kid.
Sure.
And so I chose mechanical engineering because Dad's at it. It's what he does. He's good at it.
Where did you go to school?
Lafayette College in Eastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And I found out that I was not very good at mechanical engineering.
Oh, is that right?
I hated it.
What sort of things were you more inclined toward?
I came close to dropping out.
Hmm.
Matter of fact, I came so close that in the end of my sophomore year, I was walking across campus, and it was the first semester of my junior year, and I wasn't going to go home as a failure, so I was walking across campus and was going to the administration office, and I was going to drop out. I was going to go home. I was going to go in the Army. And the fellow that I passed, a good friend of mine, and his name was Bob Ferreira, passed away a number of years ago. And he said, "Where are you going, Jack?" And I'm going over to the administration, admin office, and told him what I was doing. He said, "You shouldn't do that. You ought to go over and see Doc McGady over in the materials, or what we called metallurgy at that time."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Every course you've taken in metallurgy, you're doing great." And so I turned around and walked over, and I saw Doc McGady. Dr. McGady was the head of the department. He said, "Yeah, you can transfer, but you're going to lose some time."
Mm-hmm.
And the rest is history. Successful career as a metallurgical engineer. And there was a couple other things after, because I didn't stay with that my whole career, but whole working time. But one guy can change your life.
Yeah, imagine if he hadn't intercepted you there.
I don't know where I'd be today.
Huh, interesting. You mentioned ROTC. Tell me about your time in ROTC.
We had ROTC, if I remember right, was all 4 years.
Hmm.
And there was, and the last ones were summer camp. That's where we took our basic training.
Mm-hmm.
I took my basic training at Fort Indian Town Gap. And received my commission on my graduation in June of 1965. Well, I actually liked it for quite a bit. That was more my style.
What was it that attracted you to the ROTC? What did you like about it?
I liked being outside. I liked the camaraderie. I liked the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's part of something maybe I picked up from my dad. Certainly the Boy Scout training, you know, with all of that fit right in. I'm a pretty physical guy, still am. And being outside, hiking, all of that was, I just enjoyed it.
You said that you graduated in June of 65.
Yeah.
What did you know about what the U.S. was involved with around the world, and in particular in Southeast Asia? Did you have any idea what was going on?
Nothing.
Hmm.
To be honest with you, nothing.
Yeah. So military...
to get out of school and be able to go out, and I graduated on a Friday. I started work on a Monday.
Where did you start to work?
Standard Press Steel. Now SPS Technologies, which is one of the premier fastener companies that is in the aerospace and very high-end fasteners. And that was close by, so I could stay at home. And started there as an apprentice engineer. And my time before I went into service was all during their, what they call their training, engineer training program.
Okay. And how long did it last? How long were you there before you moved over to your time in the Army?
Started there in June, and I went in the Army in October because I wanted to get the Army out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to get too deeply involved in a professional career and then have to leave for whatever time I was going to leave for. And so I asked, you know, can I get my date to go in as quickly as possible? And they gave me the date of October to go in. So I was only there for the summer.
Mm-hmm.
I had my job back when they came out, though.
Okay. So you report into the Army for your hitch there in October of 1965. Knowing that you're going in, do foreign events enter into your line of thinking at all, or are you focused on the apprenticeship?
Oh, God. We're going to get a joke out of this. They gave me the date to report in, and I was also a sports car racer, and I started actually building a car when I was in college. Now, you don't have any money, but I was able to get a wreck and start to do a lot of, you know, if you grow up on a farm, you can do a lot of things. And so I started building a race car. And as soon as I graduated, I went in and I started, went through my Sports Car Club of America, SCCA, with going to driver schools, mandatory driver schools, and then going, you become a novice driver, and you do so many novice races, and then you go up to a regional and eventually a national competition license. And I was able to do that in that time frame before I went into the Army. And I had one race on Sunday. I was supposed to report in Aberdeen, so I wrote the general. I guess I'm like my dad in a lot of ways. I wrote the general and asked, you know, can I report in a day late because I got a race? And I did. And I actually had the trophy. I took third place up in Reading, Pennsylvania. And came home, parked, you know, backed the car and trailer into the garage, and got my uniform out, which I hadn't had out since I graduated, and went to Aberdeen, which is off of Interstate 95, just north of Baltimore. Got out of the car at the, you know, where the guard is, the MP to let you in.
Mm-hmm.
Knocked my hat on the ground, and I'm looking up at this guy, and he is spit and polished. I didn't even polish my brass. And so I'm already a day late. And so I had to go and, you know, rush around and register and get all your gear and so forth and find your, you know, where your barracks are. And this will come into the story later on. But I finally did that, and I walked into the barracks with my duffel bag. And, of course, nobody has seen me because I'm behind everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So the guys turned around. And this is a World War II barracks, typical World War II barracks. And this one fella comes over, and his name was Mike Rodrigue from Greenville, South Carolina. And he introduced himself and said, you know, I introduced myself. And he says, where are y'all from? And I says, I just said, I'm from up north of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He turned around the whole barracks and says, my God, we got another Yankee here. Things were a little different back in those days.
Yeah.
And he was serious. He became my best buddy. So that's how I reported in. One day late, had a race, and then we started our training.
Tell me about that. Tell me about your time there at the Aberdeen Proving Grounds. What did that consist of? What was your daily routine like?
Well, if you want an honest word, it was a waste of time.
Huh. Why do you say that?
There was nothing that I learned at Aberdeen that had anything to do with what I did after I went through AIT and AUT, Advanced Individual and Advanced Unit Training. And I think we all said that.
What did it consist of?
Going to class, learning things like what's the size of a pentatomic division in Europe, pulling a power pack out of an M60 tank. Lieutenants, you don't do that. Just, you know, too many classes. The only thing that got me through was the fact that my PT, physical training, I was number one, and Mike and I were great handball players, and he played and I played. We got together, we played each other, and then we played in tournaments down there and so forth, and we went to class, and both of us did pretty poorly.
Hmm.
I mean, if you don't love what you're doing and you think it's a waste of time, you don't do well.
Yeah.
And I didn't. I just didn't put time into study because I couldn't see what the heck this had any purpose for. And that was pretty universal feeling when they came and interviewed us in Vietnam. Some after we were over there, is they asked us about that, and that's pretty much what we all said. Every one of us. You didn't train anything, tell us anything about what are you going to do as a second lieutenant? You didn't tell me how to be a platoon leader and a maintenance platoon.
Hmm.
I knew nothing about that. I didn't even know what the composition of a maintenance company was.
So you knew you were going into maintenance at this time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I didn't know where we were going.
Okay.
We didn't get our assignments until graduation, and then the first assignment was not what I got to go to anyway.
How long did your training last there at Aberdeen?
That started in went in October and went out in February.
Okay.
And then my first assignment, and I thought this was really neat, Sacramento, California, the depot. I said, man, this is cool. And that lasted for a short period of time, and then the second assignment came in and it said, you're going to go to Fort Riley, Kansas, to the 9th Infantry Division.
So did you even report into Sacramento?
No. No, I didn't. Took almost no leave because I wanted to save my leave.
Yeah.
So I just left Aberdeen, went home, packed my faithful 62 Ford, used, which I bought secondhand after I got out of college, and drove out to Fort Riley, Kansas.
All right. Having been to Fort Riley, Kansas on a number of occasions and knowing where you came from, what was your impression of Fort Riley?
Well, the first thing is when you came up to Fort Riley, that there was a great big sign that said home of the 1st Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
1st Infantry Division. And I'm reporting in the 9th Infantry Division. The place is almost deserted because the 1st Division had already gone. And I literally rode around until I could find, you know, some sort of a headquarters to find, you know, where do I go? What do I do? And found out that, you know, where the 709th Maintenance Battalion was located, which was where I was going to report into. And the first thing that struck me is that there's nobody there. And then I reported in to the 709th. I was the second officer into the battalion. There was an older major. I call him an old major because he had been in World War II in Korea, and he had been given a field commission in Korea.
Hmm.
He was about to retire. And there was a couple NCOs. There was a first sergeant major. And so I reported in. And I can't remember that major's name. I've tried to over the years, but I can't. And in essence, what he told me is, I need a property book officer. And which is a captain's position on battalion staff. I had no idea what that was. None
what,
whatsoever.
What does that mean? What are the responsibilities of this position?
All the equipment that comes into your unit, somebody has to sign for it and take responsibility. That's the property book.
Mm-hmm.
These are all the things that are in this whole battalion. That's trucks, helicopters, everything. And then you assign it out to the company or wherever it's going to go inside in the battalion. And so what I was told to go over to the property book office and report in to Sergeant May. And Sergeant May, which I did, not having a clue of what the heck is going on. So I reported in to Sergeant May, who was seated at his desk. And, of course, you respect the uniform, not the person. Sergeant May got up, and I introduced myself. He saluted me, sat back down. I'm standing now in front of the sergeant. I'm standing, he's sitting. He looked up and looked at me, and he said, and this is pretty well, I remember these words, "If you listen to me, Lieutenant, I will keep you out of jail."
Then you better listen, I guess, huh?
You better listen, because you are now responsible for everything in this battalion. Now, not all of it's there at that time, because there is no battalion. But this unit is going to form up very quickly. You're getting troops in. Somebody has to be assigned, responsible for the barracks they're going to go into, the equipment they're going to get assigned, the trucks, and so forth. And this is all the responsibility of the what you call the S4. That was staff position 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I started from nothing. And nothing. I had no idea. I didn't know the composition of a maintenance battalion. I didn't know the composition of a maintenance company. And now I'm signed for things coming in at all hours of the day and night, taking responsibility, and then have to reassign it after the person that's going to be using it for whatever company or so forth this is going to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hell. If you want the honest words, it was hell. It was 7 days a week. And all I was doing was following what Sergeant May told me to do. Basically, glorified clerk.
A lot of pressure, though, huh?
Yeah. And you're on battalion staff, so you're up there with the lieutenant colonel and the sergeant major who ran my ass off, completely ran my ass off. He made me everything. And I got my book, my notes in front of me. I was the battalion fire marshal, the report of survey officer, the health and recreation officer, the utilities officer. And he also had me running my ass all over the place trying to get lawnmowers in my car.
So when they're just putting the battalion together, when you're short on officers, you're going to wear a lot of hats, it sounds like.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And at that point, when I first reported in, I was the only one there other than the old major. There was nobody else in there, and there was some enlisted people, but that was it. I can't remember any more than 10 or 12 people at the most.
Mm.
Of what will become an 800-man, something like that, battalion, eventually.
Yeah. So you're building up the battalion there. Is it a foregone conclusion that Vietnam's in your future?
No.
Okay.
Didn't find that. I mean, we always, things were starting to, the newspapers and so forth, you were hearing more and more all the time. But it's still, this is 1966, and it wasn't like it was a couple years after that.
Mm-hmm.
And to be honest with you, I didn't even know where Vietnam was.
Interesting.
And the way my dad and I would write back and forth, and as I wrote in my memoirs, and I think this comes out of my letters, because I had all 60, I was only missing one of the 60-some letters I sent home. Time Magazine, May 16th, there was an article in there, the 9th Division was going to Vietnam. And so I wrote, I remember either talking to my dad or writing home, and then he sent back a National Geographic map of the Southeast Asia, and highlighted Vietnam.
Hmm.
That's how it sounds dumb, but that's how naive it was. I was.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, we all were. I don't think I was any different than anybody else. maybe the older officers, the captains and majors and so forth. But for us young lieutenants, it was every day was just go do your job.
And plus your job, your duties were pretty extensive and keeping you very busy as well.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Recreation was in the barracks at night. It was a TV, didn't have anything. I had a little TV that I bought, but you couldn't pick up anything. It was almost all snow because there's no satellites or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a little a little clock radio. I remember I could get one or two stations on it. And then this is what we did. Most of the time we sat around and drank bush beer at night in the barracks. That's the way it was. Now we did. Close by is I think University of Kansas was up in Manhattan.
K-State. Yeah.
And we used to go up there and try to, I was in a fraternity in college. There was a fraternity. My fraternity was up there. One of my good friends, we were both in the same fraternity in college. He was from Georgia and I was from Pennsylvania. And so we went up and we'd go to some of the fraternity parties and things like that. But there wasn't a whole lot of time for that.
Mm-hmm. So you're preparing to ship out. Are you bringing in new personnel for the unit as well?
Yeah.
Beefing up the numbers?
The whole thing fleshed out.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally, in May, well, two things were really kind of neat. One was the colonel of the battalion sent out a request. And by that time, by May, I had been finally put down into what we call a forward support company.
Okay.
And he was a handball player. And I was a handball player all through college and then at Aberdeen. And he was looking for somebody to play handball with at lunch. And his name was Colonel Post. And I play handball. So they got me out of the S4 office because almost every day at lunch, I reported up to the gym to either doubles or singles with Colonel Post.
Hmm.
And we did very well. We won the post championships, and then we went to the inner service. They had an inner service tournament, and we did good, but we lost at the end up to two guys in the Air Force that whipped us pretty bad. They played a different type of game than we did. And the other thing was, you look back on youth and you wonder how you got the energy, but I mentioned that race car.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I wrote the general and asked him if I could bring my race car out. And surprisingly, I got the answer, yes. And so Mom and Dad towed it all the way out. They towed it out to about St. Louis. And I met them in St. Louis and, switched the trailer. It was on a trailer. Switched the trailer from their car to my car. We spent an hour or two together. And then I took it back to Fort Riley, and I had rented a little garage off post, two bay garage, just like a little house garage.
Mm-hmm.
And went racing. I even sold duty. If I had weekend duty, I'd find somebody and sell them, selling my duty. I'll pay you if you take my duty for on Saturday or something. And we went racing.
Still have that love of cars in you, apparently.
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in a maintenance outfit. So guess what kind of guys are in maintenance outfits?
Car guys.
Car guys. And we won. We couldn't make all the races by any means. But they were my pit crew. They were my mechanics. And we won or placed first or second in every event we went to.
Hmm.
And it was enough to get me to the national championships in Riverside, California. Be invited to go at the end of the season. 21 drivers, 7 regional divisions, 3 from each region. I was one of the ones invited to go to Riverside, California. Never made it, but that was pretty neat.
Yeah.
But I had some great guys. I had fuel and electric specialists. You know, I mean, I had car guys. I had drag car guys. And, you know, that's what you get in the maintenance battalion. And they were with me all the way.
When does the 9th receive, or at least the 709th, receive orders to ship out for Vietnam?
We got our orders. We're leaving in November.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it worked out was I had to get the car and everything home. And there was one last race I wanted to run. And that was a Vineland 4-hour. And I had won it the year before I went into service, or the year I went into the service. And so I had Friday night duty, I remember that. So you're a duty officer, so didn't have much sleep. And then I had the car all packed. And all I had to do was go back to the, put the trailer on and drive home. So I drove home, 23 hours and 15 minutes nonstop, towing the car.
Hmm.
You didn't have the interstates that you have today.
Right.
And we got home and prepped up the car. The race was the following Saturday. And took second. Should have taken first, but I didn't have a pit crew, so I had to borrow some people and borrow a pit. And so when I came in, if somebody else was in the pit, I had to wait my turn to get fuel and service.
I see.
And that cost me the race because I wasn't that far behind. But this took second, came home, backed the thing into Mom and Dad's garage, and I had, through my racing out there, I met a girl out in Oklahoma City, and very nice girl, great family, and I wanted to say goodbye, so I turned around and drove to Oklahoma City and stayed with her for a day at her, and she lived at home, and then went back, and right after that, Mom and Dad flew out to drive the car home because I had the car out there, and that was our last goodbye, and then we left, and we took went over to the airport and got on a prop-driven plane and flew out to Oakland.
Once you get out to Oakland, what are your responsibilities, and how are you planning to head to Southeast Asia from this point?
We went over by ship. And
what was the ship?
USS General William Weigel.
Okay.
It was a World War II transport. P-2 transport was the configuration. We built a number of these for to transport troops in World War II. It took the whole brigade, so there was roughly 3,000 plus men on it.
Okay.
3,300 or something like that. The whole brigade plus support troops were on the on the Weigel. So all we did is fly into Oakland and went from directly from the plane to the Weigel, got on the Weigel, and within a very short period of time, we sailed underneath the Golden Gate Bridge.
Tell me about this trip over to Southeast Asia aboard the Weigel. What was this like? How long did it take, and what was it like for you? Give me some details of this.
Well, put it plainly, I resolved when I got off the damn thing I would never get on another sea cruise in my life, and I've lived that resolve to this day. And it was not fun. We hit our first storm within shortly after leaving San Francisco. If you can imagine being locked below decks with 3,000 plus people, and probably 90% of them are sick at one time.
It must have been
That's
a little rough.
That's what it was like.
Yeah.
And, of course, we lieutenants, we had a little, if you want to call it, we had a little statement. That's bull crap. So, but it was, at least a bunch of us were in us, you know, was not as bad as down in the troop decks, where they were just stacked on top of each other. And I tried getting in my bunk and putting life vests and all you did is get thrown from the one end to the other. And then I knew if I stayed there, I was going to be sick. And so, against regulations, I found a way to get up underneath the forecastle without being seen. And so I did. I went all the way up to the forecastle, the front part of the ship, which is raised. And then the deck is, you know, you could kind of hide under there. And spend a lot of time up there and by myself.
Why did you find this spot? What was drawing you to this spot?
I had to get away from it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I mean, if you can imagine, the vomit was so thick down in some of the areas down where the troops were, it was like water going from one side to the other, except it was vomit.
Mm.
And up with some of the officers' areas, it wasn't much better. It's seasickness is not fun. And so I disobeyed the rules. But I found I could get up to there, and I could actually look out through. There was a porthole there, which was used for attaching, for the lines, the hawsers when they would dock the ship.
Mm-hmm.
You could actually look out into the face of the storm, and this is not a lie. I can tell you I saw almost the whole bow of that ship out of the water, and then every marking, the Roman numerals for the deck, all the way down, and then it would bury itself into the wave. And it was like being inside Niagara Falls looking out. Because I'm up underneath, in this little area with the deck above me for a short distance, and then the main deck, I'm standing on. And it was actually like being in Niagara Falls looking out.
Pretty rough seas.
And I can give you a video on YouTube that I found that for me was a complete flashback. And it's a beautiful song. It's Phil Coulter, C-O-U-L-T-E-R,
mm-hmm.
Phil Coulter, The Lonesome Boatman. And my wife is Irish, and so it's an Irish, The Lonesome Boatman's an Irish song. And Phil Coulter was born in the same town as my mother-in-law on my wife's side. And I just came across this one night, and what it is Phil Coulter's rendition of The Lonesome Boatman, but it's a ship at sea in a storm. It is exactly like it was.
I'll have to check that out.
Phil Coulter, The Lonesome Boatman, it's about 4 minutes and 34 seconds long. And it's a beautiful song to begin with, but it's that's what it was like. That's what it's like. And that's why I said I will never get on one of these things. If I make it through this, I'm never getting on one of these things again.
Well, in addition to avoiding seasickness as much as possible, what else are you doing on the ship? It takes, what, a month to get over there?
It's almost 21 days or something like that. Read a lot. We did have a very short... Okinawa, we got off for a very short period of time, and it wasn't 24 hours, maybe 6 hours or something like that. Just enough to get down and, visit a few honky-tonks and get back on. And then as we went down through the South China Sea, it changed radically because we're now getting warmer where we came across the Pacific in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And... it got to be so still that, and this is a pretty large size ship, that you could spit off the side and you could actually follow your spit down to the water and see a ripple. That's how calm it was. And it's a diesel ship, and so the diesel fumes would go up and they would just come back and like hang over the back of the ship. So you wanted to get up topside and get all the way up where the life rafts were and find yourself a good spot. And that was it.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a whole lot you could do. There was a little PT exercise. You tried to do that. But with 3,000 guys on board, what can you do?
Right.
You get your eats, your food, And then, honestly, you get bored. At least not for me. I'm an active guy, and it wasn't very active. I did take a weight set with me, a spring set, to keep in shape. And so I worked out with those, which was very helpful, because when we got to Vietnam and had become from a cold climate to a warm climate, I was probably in a little better shape than most everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked out with that. I had a set of jump ropes, like the boxers use.
Right.
So I worked out with those and passed them around if anybody wanted to use them, at least within our small group. And other than that, there wasn't a whole lot to do.
Now, was this just purely a troop ship, or did you have some equipment on there with you as well?
No. All of our equipment, it was strictly a troop ship.
Okay.
The equipment, I was a loading officer for the company. We had packed all that up, and that went by rail down to someplace on the Gulf, probably New Orleans or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that went by transport, and we arrived in Vietnam about the 17th of December, 1966, in that time frame, and in Vung Tau, it was in the southern part mm-hmm. of the country. And our equipment didn't come in until about January 1st.
So what are you doing in the meantime once you reach Vung Tau?
We landed on, if I look at my records here, I think we landed about the 16th of December. We got off ship on the 17th. And we actually went down the side of the ship, just like the ramps or the ropes that you see from Normandy and other invasion sites in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, and I said, when I went down, I said, my God, my dad must have done this. And here I'm doing it over again.
Yeah.
And then we got on a small landing craft, and in front of it was, bigger than the Higgins boat of World War II, because our whole company got on this thing. And then when we motored to the shore, and I was all the way up front, and I had my little Instamatic camera, a little Kodak Instamatic,
mm-hmm.
that would fit into an ammunition pouch. It was perfect size for an ammunition pouch. I carried that most of my trip, over my tour over there. And so I ran off ahead of as soon as the ramp went down, I ran off ahead and I turned around and I snapped a photograph of Echo Company coming off of this landing craft. And I snapped that picture. I didn't get the one I should have taken immediately afterwards. It was my buddy Mike that I talked about, my
right.
handball buddy from Aberdeen days.
Mm-hmm.
Who I had not seen, but we had been writing back and forth. And it was just like the movie. And there's Mike. And he says, "Hi, Jack. Welcome to Vietnam." And I turned around and said, "My God, it's Mike." Of course, we hugged each other. And he had somehow finagled a job to be the liaison for the our group coming into Vietnam.
Oh, I see.
He is an officer for our company, because he was an ordnance officer. He was stationed in Vung Tau in a depot area, which becomes very important later on.
Hmm.
And so he had finagled this position. Mike's a finagler, by the way. if you want somebody who can get anything, you go see Mike.
I see.
And so he was assigned to us, so he actually went with us in the convoy up to Bearcat, was our first home, which was also, prior to that, was at one time, I believe, also the 1st Infantry Division before they went up towards the Tay Ninh area.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was with us for some period of time. I have photographs of us, the two of us, together at Bearcat. I remember Christmas night on the berm with Mike and I drinking Korean beer on the berm. And then I did some stupid things.
Now, this is still at Vung Tau?
No, this is, we went, immediately got on in the 1st Division, and the Aussies escorted us up to Bearcat.
Okay, so you go straight to Bearcat. Okay, I got you.
Straight to Bearcat. And when we got to Bearcat, we had nothing. We had some old leftover tents that were left there. The only thing we had was our duffel bag, what we brought with us. Which incidentally had my personal 45 and my own ammunition, because I was a range officer at Fort Riley, and we were given the M16 just before we left, the brand new M16.
Uh-huh.
They took away the M14.
What did you think of the M16?
It misfired so much on the range, I went home and bought my own 45 and my own ammunition and took it with me.
I kind of figured that was where you were going with that.
Tell you how I got it home, but I did get it home. But the M16 misfired. I just couldn't the M14 was beautiful. And then we got this M16, which we're all brand new with. This was just weeks before we left. And I didn't trust it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how I did this either, but I managed to get a 3/4 ton. And I asked the company commander, Captain Foss, could I go to Saigon?
I've got to stop you there, Jack.
Okay.
How in the world do you're new in country and you're needing things, and all of a sudden you just come up with a 3/4 ton truck? How did that work?
There were some units at Bearcat. Went over and asked them if I could borrow a 3/4 ton truck.
Okay.
So I got a 3/4 ton truck.
I see.
The old World War II 3/4 ton. It was indestructible.
Yes, they were.
It was an indestructible truck. A flathead 6, it never failed. And you're young. You know, you think you're Rambo. And I asked the company commander. He gave me permission. And I had a driver and had two guys in the back and me in the front seat with our trusty M16s, and we went to Saigon. And we got folding chairs, we got beer, and we got wing tanks. We got a wing tank from Tonsonut, and because we didn't have any showers. And from a wing tank, you can make a shower and hold it back. And of course, the company commander, they got folding chairs before, the junior officers.
I'm sure.
This is not the whole company. But anyway, so I did that twice, and everybody enjoyed the beer and so forth like that. And when you have nothing, even warm beer is good.
Oh, yeah.
And the chair is great when you have nothing to sit on. And then shortly after my second trip, somebody else tried it, and I saw the vehicle that they had. It was a Jeep, and when they brought that vehicle in, there must have been 150 holes all through it, and they were all killed.
Wow.
And that's when I wised up. That was my wake-up call, that this is not fun and games, this is real. This is not, you better get your head on, screw it on straight.
I was going to ask you about that, if you had any idea what the enemy disposition was in that area, what the activity level was in that area. And apparently you didn't know, or you wouldn't.
No.
Might not have made those trips.
No.
But it's serious now. Yeah.
We had our whole training at Fort Riley for deployment to Vietnam. We had one field exercise. One time we went out in the prairie and set up our tents and so forth and did some maintenance in the field. That was it. Every job that I'm in, I'm just learning from an NCO. And I was lucky to have, throughout my whole time in service, some very, very great NCOs who were nice enough to take me under their wing. And that's what made me an officer. Not the Army, not any training that I had. It was the sergeants that I had that took me and made me, I think, by the end, a pretty good lieutenant. I learned everything from them.
Now that you're in Bearcat, take me through the process of getting things established there, getting the company established. What are you guys going to be up to? What's going on there?
Okay. Once we started getting in equipment, as soon as we started getting in equipment, we went into operations. One of the things I was able to get, and I got this from the scrapyard down at Long Bend, was a towed grader. It might have even been French, but
yeah.
It was in the scrapyard down at Long Bend.
It's a road grader?
Yeah, it's a road grader.
Okay.
It's towed behind a truck.
Mm-hmm.
It has no motor on it, but it's it's got a plow underneath and so forth like that. And that we use that to level out the company area. And then once we started getting our equipment in, started setting up tents and things like that. And went into operation as soon as the equipment came in. But I wasn't there very long. So we started getting equipment in the 1st of January, according to my records. And then by the 10th of January, I'm out of there.
Where did you go?
It was a 25-man task force, which had each of the selected areas of the company. In other words, we had some maintenance people, we had radio people, we had people that, armament people and so forth. We were designated to go into the Mekong Delta to a place called Dong Tam.
Okay.
And it was the 10th of January that our 25-man task force, along with just a couple companies of infantry, it was a C-123, took us down to a landing strip, which, as I recall, was some sort of special forces type thing, in the Delta. The flight in was so steep that I remember that specifically, because they didn't want to take ground fire. So, like, you come in the commercial airport, you kind of come in nice and gradual.
Mm-hmm.
We dropped. They just were up there, and they just dropped down. Then they transferred us into Chinooks, and we took the Chinooks into Dong Tam.
Describe Dong Tam to me. What did that look like in January of 66?
The mud pile. It was Dong Tam was made out of dredgings from the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
And there was three dredges, as I remember right, there were three dredges. They were pumping this slurry up. And what they do is they build a berm, pump the slurry, which contained a lot of muck and mud, into this area, and then let it evaporate. So you were actually building a built-up base, out of the mud and so forth that would then dry, at least in the summer season, non-monsoon season, into what became the base of Dong Tam, large base. But it eventually became the home of the 9th Infantry Division.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were there, when we first went in there, we were it. And we were the perimeter. They told us that the VC are going to react violently. And so we were serving as, perimeter. And I have photographs in my book there that shows building our own little bunkers and so forth like that. And that was it. This whole base, we were the first ones there from the 9th Division.
Hmm.
And two of the drag lines or dredges had been blown up already. There was one operating. And it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But we were the first ones in from the 9th Division. My buddy Mike says he was there just before us, but we've argued about that for 50 years.
Probably will continue to argue about it.
Yeah, we'll never solve that one. He says he was there before. I said, no, Mike, when I went in, there was nobody there. I got photographs. No, I was there. But
so you guys are in charge of security then, right?
We were right on the perimeter, and
yeah.
The only person there that had any experience was our first sergeant who had served in Korea. So he was the man in charge. He set up where we're going to go, where the machine, our M60 went, where the bunkers went and so forth. None of us had any experience. We weren't taught any of this.
Yeah, you're maintenance. What do you feel, or how do you feel about being put down here in this position all of a sudden, brand new in Vietnam, and there you are by yourselves in Dong Tam?
I just did what I was told.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, my dad had a, you know, well, anyway, if there's somebody there that knows what to do, be smart enough to let them do it.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I never looked at a lieutenant, my position as lieutenant, other than the fact that I'm a designated leader. If I know what has to be done, and I think this is the way to do it, then that's the way it's going to be done. If I don't know, find somebody who does.
Right.
Or in other words, one of the things that I've learned out of this time in the service that became most important through my whole career was find the best people. In my engineering career and things I've done later in life, I never claimed to be the best of whatever I did, but I was almost always in the managerial position. It was find the best people you can.
Mm-hmm.
And give them everything they need to do their job. You're a facilitator, you're a player coach at the best.
Yeah.
You follow my reasoning.
Sure.
And that worked for me very well. There are areas where I did have expertise, and there's areas I do not. If I do not, find the best person that's there. And as for, it was just, what else are you going to do?
Right. So what did you do? There you are in Dong Tam. Take me through it.
We went in with no equipment other than what we carried in. But within a very short period of time, we started to receive our company equipment to support the operations that came up came by riverboat up the Mekong River.
Mm-hmm.
And Dong Tam was located right off of the Mekong River. Matter of fact, I've got photographs taken from a helicopter where you can see our position and look, and right beyond it is the Mekong River. So it came in, and as soon as we got our equipment in, we started doing maintenance work. And that included artillery, it included mechanized. We did an awful lot of work with the M113 armored personnel carriers.
Yeah, tell me about this in as much detail as you can, Jack. I mean, I want to know what kind of equipment you have, because I've seen some of the photographs of some of the things. They're really impressive. It was the M88, I guess. Tell me about the equipment that you had and your responsibilities, what units you're supporting, what kind of equipment you're working on. How does that all work?
We had the capabilities, and I look at it as we're like AAA. You break down on the side of the road, and if we can get you going there, we'll get you going there. If you can't, we'll bring you in and fix you up.
Mm-hmm.
We don't repair motors, we change them. If an M113 armored personnel carrier has a mechanical failure, we have the capability to bring it in. We have flatbed trailers. We have 2.5 and 5 ton wreckers. We also had our M88, which we didn't have it this time, but eventually, which has a capability. You can lift the whole M113 and put it on the trailer.
It's pretty impressive to see.
Yeah. Now, the M88 didn't do much good because you couldn't go many places down there, but it served a good purpose when you're within the camp confines, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You can't take it out in the field. It's going to sink.
Right.
And artillery, we had artillery specialists that handle our artillery needs. We had a recovery section. We had welders. We had small arms specialists. We had radio repairmen. In other words, within our company of a little over 100, we had expertise in just about anything that you need to support the units that you're supporting, including everything from their small arms up to the artillery, their trucks, their vehicles, assuming they had that. But most of the time in the Delta, we were dealing with armored mechanized people, and it was the M113s. which took a hell of a beating down there.
Now that you've established what you're going to be doing, take me through a typical day for you. What would it look like from the time you got up through till the time you laid your head back down again?
As I remember, a normal day started about 5:30, and breakfast was served, powdered eggs, things like that, and then the troops went to their assigned stations, you know, where they're working. By then, we had our tents and so forth in place. You looked at your backlog, most important things first, and then this went on 7 days a week for the most part. So it was just, I called it every day's Tuesday. Never the beginning, it's never the end. And it wasn't all bad. I mean, being in Dong Tam, being in the base itself, other than when we got mortared or so forth like that, was not a bad assignment. I'm not walking point out in the if you know what I mean.
Sure.
There's a big difference. We were hit within the base. They walked mortars right through our area. I'm here because I chose one side of a row of sandbags, and the 82 millimeter hit on the other side. So as my dad said, an inch is as good as a mile. I didn't understand that. And that was his World War II expression. I understood it that night. Just rolled on the right side. We lost two men, both wounded, no killed, but they killed six that night when they walked through our area. When I say walked through, and my buddy Mike got a Bronze Star of a V because they set a fire in the ammo dump. And he and a sergeant went in and threw the burning ammunition cases over the berm. But it was nonstop. Repair parts and so forth were very hard to get. And I mentioned Mike and being down in depot.
Right.
And I asked the company commander if I could go to Vung Tau. And I did this on a number of occasions. And I would make up a wish list. You know, I need this, I need this, I need this. And then I'd go over to helipad, and I'd find a helicopter that's going in the general direction I wanted to go. And eventually I'd get to Vung Tau. And I'd hook up with Mike down there, and he took good care of me. I came up the river with pallets of parts. None of this is legal, by the way.
No,
well, I hope you're not
going to...
including a whole pallet of Budweiser beer. One pallet of Budweiser beer on one trip, and boy, they loved it. But at that point, our normal supply was not getting the things we need.
What sort of things would you be short on?
The parts we needed to fix the stuff we were asked to fix.
Give me an example.
Oh God. Fuel pumps, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
God, I forget all the stuff. I don't even know if I wrote it down, but there's types of things you need. If you have a truck down, there's something wrong with it. And it may not be the whole motor. It may be a steering gear or something like that. Then I need that. And you could that would be requisitioned. The requisition would go all the way back to the division base up in Bearcat, and then it would have to come down to us. And I was able to do a whole lot better by going down to Vung Tau and bring it up in up a boat coming up the river.
Just kind of taking care of it yourself and circumventing the normal.
Yeah, exactly.
Normal rules, right.
We did that a lot.
You talked
about.
We did
a lot of stuff that would get you court-martialed today.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm not saying, I've talked to guys in the modern army. And I said, I couldn't live in this army. Well, maybe it's different, but, you know, Dad had an expression, the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
Mm-hmm.
And just, if you got to do what you got to do, and push it as hard as you can until you get your fingers burnt, and then pull back. That was another one of his expressions in life.
You mentioned getting mortared down there in Dongtan. What is that like? Take me through what it would be like to be to go through a mortar barrage.
It's pretty scary. Anybody, you know, it says they're not afraid. Well, maybe there's some people, but it's not me. The first thing you hear is this sound. Just go, and you immediately know what that is. And you head for a bunker and try to get there as fast as possible. Most of our bigger bunkers, we had perforated steel planking, so we had sandbags on top,
mm-hmm.
on sides both. You try to take care of and look for all your men, make sure your men are all there, that everybody's gotten into a facility. And if you're inside the bunker, it's mostly just at that point, you just wait it out.
How long might it last?
Wasn't that long. It didn't last that long. We also got hit with 76 millimeter pack howitzers, which incidentally the infantry had managed to capture some later on, and we had given them to the Chinese in World War II, from the date they were U.S. manufactured and the dates are on them. The mortars were 82s because the Chinese manufactured theirs. Ours are 81s, and supposedly an 82 would not fit in an 81, but you could fire in the reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what it was because it was during the dry season, and when I rolled on the side of the sandbags, it exploded on the other side, and the tail section embedded in the hard pack. And I actually had a part of the back end of the thing, and I brought it home and had it as a souvenir for a long time.
Hmm.
The company itself, one third each night was on perimeter duty, so your men were working during the day, and a certain amount of men would be then one third of the company would be on perimeter duty at night. And then the officers rotated as the officer in charge for the perimeter to make sure everything was okay on, for the guys out there, make sure they stayed awake. And to be honest with you, the only time I saw a VC was through a starlight scope on the perimeter that I knew in an enemy. I mean, not a captive or something like that, but the only time I saw an enemy that I knew was an enemy was a starlight scope on the perimeter in Dongtan.
What was the level of activity, enemy activity, in that area while you were there?
It was not like up north, where you had, like, caisson and stuff like that. It wasn't like that. But on one of my trips down to my buddy down in Vung Tau, I went over, I was on the helicopter, and I was sitting on the pad, and the helicopter was warming up. And off on the perimeter, there was an explosion, fairly large black cloud. And immediately they threw us off the helicopter. And I'll never forget it. The helicopter took off, went a very short distance, and came back in, and there was men just piled up across the floor.
Hmm.
And when they got them all out and brought people back in, and again, it was an NCO. Okay, get dirt and throw it in there and clean it up. He was crew chief or, one of the crewmen on the helicopter. There was times when, I remember distinctly a sniper round. And then there was another night we were in our tent, sandbag tent. There was an explosion, and they had lack of a better word, it was like a steam shovel, but it wasn't steam, it was a motorized thing, which wasn't that far from us at all. And it was guarded by a squad of soldiers, and the VC had come in and set us charge off and blew it up. And it wasn't I'm not talking 100 yards away or nothing like that. That's how close they came in.
Wow.
But it was that nitpicking stuff. And, God, for the guys out in the field going through the mush and, you know, what the Mekong Delta is like, it was hell for those guys. But it was always there. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
And now I'm not a ground combat officer. I'm not claiming to be. Different ball game.
Right. Well, it certainly gives you an appreciation for what those guys went through, especially down with the 9th working in the Delta.
Yep.
In those kind of conditions.
And we also used to go out on field operations, recovery operations. Mm-hmm. I've got some pictures in my my notes that I, you know, my booklet I put together of a whole series of M113s all bogged down in this very swampy type of terrain.
Yeah.
And it would all look the same when you looked across it, and then all of a sudden you sink down, and it's this this grass with it all clogged up into the idler arms and so forth like that, and you just, you're not going anywhere. I also worked with the had some operations with a counterpart in the South Vietnamese Army, which I found to be very rewarding. And, the only thing I said, geez, I'm going home when my time's, this guy's here forever.
Yeah. Well, tell me about that, if you would, Jack. What were the circumstances around that?
We did some liaison where we tried to assist them in some of our techniques and, you know, learning experience. And that's what we did. This is how we operate, and this is, you know, so forth like that. I found that to be teaching, and, you know, and I found that to be pretty rewarding. It wasn't a whole lot of time, but it was another experience. Let me put it that way.
Yeah. What did you?
I actually felt sorry for them.
That's what I wanted to ask you, is what your opinion was of the South Vietnamese forces and the South Vietnamese people.
If you take away the war, South Vietnam is actually a very beautiful place. The areas that I was in, the Delta, is something that is so different than anything I'd ever experienced. And the... I had no animosity towards anybody, really, none whatsoever. I was just asked to do a job and went and did it. The few South Vietnamese that I came in contact with, they're human beings just like we are. That poor guy that I may have worked with, his wife and children were there, and they were targets too.
Mm-hmm.
If you were in the South Vietnamese military, your family was a target. So in that sense, I had a lot of respect for them. I don't have any animosity. I don't have any bad feelings for them. The ones that I worked with were great people.
Mm-hmm.
Personal experience.
Why don't we stop there for today, Jack? This is Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Mr. John DeLong. Today is 3 April 2018. I'm in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. DeLong is joining me by telephone again from Huntingdon Valley, Pennsylvania. Okay, Jack, we have you there in Dong Tam. Again, like I mentioned a little bit ago, you kind of give us the lay of the land, what it looks like, what you guys are up to on a daily basis, the units you're supporting, and these kinds of things. So, what else comes to mind when you think about your time there in Dong Tam?
Well, I wrote something down after I spoke to you last week, and I had mentioned that we were given the M16 just a matter of weeks before we shipped out.
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken my own 45 because I was not very impressed with the weapon when we went through range training at Fort Riley. So, when we got in country, the first day we were at Dong Tam, everybody was on perimeter. It didn't make any difference whether you were on you were maintenance people or whether you were infantry people or engineer people. Now, anyway, so one afternoon, a bunch of us went out to the berm and to test fire our new M16s, which were spotless. And my dad, being the engineer he was, he had given me a couple containers of a special water dispersing oil to maintain the weapon. And this is Dad and his World War II training. And to make a long story short, went out to the berm. I fired one round, and that damn thing jammed.
Really?
Stopped firing. And it was a brand new weapon, brand new ammunition. We had not been out. And we're maintenance people. We're not running through the muck and the mud.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of problems with that. We even had what they called a congressional come down, which were people from Washington to interview us, and because of our repair capabilities and servicing these weapons, and try to find out what was, you know, take information back on some of the problems we had with that thing very early.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of, you know, maybe something that would be of interest.
Yeah, you're certainly not the only person who's mentioned that, especially in the early days. The M16 was notorious for jamming. Of course, when it jams is when you're firing it. When you're firing, it's when you need it. So it was certainly problematic, and a lot of folks had some pretty sour feelings about that particular weapon early on.
Yeah, I actually understand, and I witnessed people coming in from the field, infantry types, that were carrying something other than M16s.
Mm-hmm.
Whether other people have said that or not, I do remember that. If they could capture an AK-47, that... those were pretty reliable weapons.
Yeah. Or whatever else was in the U.S. inventory to replace it.
Yeah.
M14s,
some people had
course, yeah.
The M1 carbine from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I saw that. The only M1s I ever saw were in the hands of the South Vietnamese, which to me were kind of ludicrous. And I did mention that we had some liaison with South Vietnamese units, and that was okay for an American who was generally a little bit bigger than his South Vietnamese counterpart. But I did see the M1s in the hands of the South Vietnamese, and that's a lot of weapon for a small guy,
mm-hmm.
small person.
Sure.
But anyway, the environment down there was you know, pretty much, as I said, almost since the time we got in country, it's 24/7. Didn't have a lot of opportunities to go out in the field. Did on some occasions on recovery missions.
Take me on one of these recovery missions, Jack. Well, how would it come down that you would have to go out? Take me through the whole process of vehicle out in the field. Message gets to you guys. How does that whole process work? And take me out to the field.
You would receive a notification that there was a vehicle that was blown or had hit a mine or some sort of battle damages that could not be moved, and you would then be asked to go out in escort. You did not go out like we did by ourselves, and pick the vehicle up and bring it back in.
What would you take with you to go out there?
Generally, a wrecker and a flatbed.
Mm-hmm.
On other occasions, we went out to serve as advisors. In one particular case, there was a whole bunch of M113s that had gone through the, that were in the, well, we called it the Plain of Reeds.
Mm-hmm.
And about a half a dozen of these M113s were completely immobilized in the Plain of Reeds.
What had happened to them?
They just got bogged down in the muck and the grass.
I see.
And once, you know, it started churning up into the wheels and so forth, and they were just immobilized. I actually have a picture in my book, the little booklet I wrote, and what was done there was took the winches off of one, swung it out to another one, and used each one like an island to pull one in and pull the next one in and pull back in until you got on ground that was firm enough that you could actually move the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And we were asked, two officers were asked to go out and offer assistance in that case there.
So what kind of service would you try to offer? Are you trying to fix anything out there, or are you just bringing it back in? What are you doing?
Just offer assistance in terms of how you're going to get these things out of the muck and the grime.
Mm-hmm.
And work with the men on site. But we didn't break any vehicles or anything out there. There was no way we could get out there other than what was there already.
Right.
So it swing from one to the other, and then we're able to get those lead vehicles back into on relatively firm ground.
Yeah, the conditions there were, especially during the rainy season, were just awful for these kinds of tracked vehicles, for any vehicle, I guess, for that matter.
Yeah. You had two choices. It was either mud, muck, and if the sun came out, you had mud, muck, and dust blowing in your face because the top would dry out. But no, it was a different environment than we were used to. When, you know, if you come from this country here, maybe down in Louisiana in the south, you'd have something like that. But for those of us who came from the north, it was an alien environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine so. Well, tell me about the people who worked for you there, Jack. Tell me about the maintenance crews.
Excellent group of men. These are almost all draftees. We had no problems. The expertise was very, very high. The enthusiasm. It was very easy to be an officer in the Echo Company of the 709th. It was actually pretty easy.
Hmm.
The guys knew what to do, the sergeants. And I always complimented my NCOs, and I still, to this day, as the NCOs were actually fantastic. The hardest problems we have, as I mentioned before, was of getting repair parts. And I did mention sometimes that, went out of the supply chain and did it on my own, but it worked. And worked pretty well. I was there until May. And actually, at that point, I was kind of figuring I'd finish out my tour down there. And I got a call from the company commander, who was brand new to us. They were starting in the division to rotate men, because the division came into country at one time. If you let everybody exactly the same, everybody was going to go home at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So they started moving us around. Started first with our company commander, Captain Foss, and he was relieved by a new officer, and I'll be honest to goodness, I don't even remember the man's name. But he called me in, and I was told to pack my, get my duffel bag, go over to helipad, and take the helicopter back up to Bearcat, and I'm getting a new assignment.
Hmm. So you went back up to Bearcat from Dongtam. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I went back to Bearcat. Was only there for a very short period of time, and then got back on another helicopter and was taken out to Charlie Company, which was up by the Cambodian border, up past Tainan.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on operations. Totally different environment. Totally different environment. Charlie Company was like vagabonds. They were never in the same place for very long. They were constantly on the move, and which is different from us down in the Delta. And I reported in as the new shop officer, directly under the company commander.
Hmm.
So it was a big change.
Yeah. Describe.
First place, I'm the new guy on the block.
Right.
The majority of the guys there have been together since they formed up back at Fort Riley. And then their shop officer was sent someplace else, and then I come in. So I'm, I know nobody.
Right.
Let me put it that way.
What's it like for you to come into this new unit when everyone else has been there for a while?
A little scary. They have their way of doing things. They know each other. They know their strengths and personalities, you know, because they've been together a long time, and they went over by ship just like we did, but it was not the same one.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to make your own way. I look back at it as probably one of the greatest training experiences I ever had in terms of life experience, because you're now the shop officer of a company that in some ways operated somewhat differently than what I was used to. But by this time, I had had enough training in the company I came from, and I remember and so many times I've said how good my NCOs were.
Mm-hmm.
in teaching me. And so I did not come in as a novice. I came in with a doggone good idea of how a company should run. And to be honest with you, it worked out very, very well.
Hmm. What sort of things did they do differently from what you were used to, Jack?
The supply chain that they had worked much more efficiently than we had. let me tell you a little story about things. Shop officer is supposed to have a Jeep, and because you have responsibilities of visiting the units you support. If you're in convoy, you will probably be a convoy lead or a segment leader. And when I came in, I found out that the Jeep that I was supposed to have had been taken by a major up in battalion headquarters, overruling the local company commander. And so I didn't have one. And it sounds kind of simple, you know, he took my Jeep. Well, damn it, that's pretty important. Because if you don't have mobility, how do you do your job? And so it took about a couple weeks for them to get a feeling for me and for me for them. And then the maintenance platoon sergeant came over and he says, "Hey, Lieutenant, I'll get you a Jeep." And so what happened was that they waited till the Jeep came into the salvage section, or came into for repair that would be salvaged.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that in this case, this Jeep had an altercation with a tank, and the structure was bent, which is a salvageable item. You can't fix that. And so we give them a requisition so they can requisition a new vehicle. We declare it salvage. And in the space of about a week or two, that Jeep was brand new.
Hmm.
And I had that Jeep totally bogus. Charlie 51. Everything about that Jeep was bogus. And there was only two Jeeps in the whole division that were not painted olive drab. One was the commanding general's Jeep, which had been repainted it was like a semi-gloss, and then old Lieutenant DeLong, he had the same color.
The resourcefulness of the maintenance companies.
Yep, and one fellow that was a body shop man in his civilian life, he did most of the work, and they straightened it out. It was gorgeous. It was gorgeous. I mean, it didn't look like that when we came in from an operation.
Mm-hmm.
But it was probably one of the nicer looking vehicles. We even had vinyl seat covers on it with white pinstriping. GIs are GIs. You know, we're young guys.
Yeah, it doesn't matter the conflict or who you are. It's just timeless kind of thing.
Yep. Yeah, anybody's ever served will, in most cases, will always remember the guys that you serve with. And for my era, it's the guys. We're not integrated with females.
Yeah.
So when I refer to guys, it's strictly that's the way it was for me.
Mm-hmm.
The operations up there, now I'm up by Tain Inn. The base that we operated out was a former home of the 196 Light Infantry Brigade, which had moved up north. And it was different. I spent a lot more time out in the field observation, going out by helicopter, going into fire support bases. Had some times when, let me put it this way, being totally lost in a monsoon rain in a helicopter when you can't see anything in any direction. And then he's looking for a little fire support base up by the Cambodian border. And then he would lower down into the out of the rainforest, so to speak, look around, and then go up. And I don't know how the hell he, in this one case, he ever found a fire support base, but eventually we did. Remember taking ground fire on some missions. Luck is luck.
Yeah. What's it like to take ground fire when you're up in a helicopter?
Just hang on. Nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a passenger. I'm sitting there, and you're taking pretty heavy ground fire, and you got nothing to do with the situation. You're not flying it. You're doing that. You're just a passenger. That's all I am.
Yeah.
I remember on one occasion, he banked the thing literally 90 degrees sideways, so that you're looking out of the plane, and you had a seatbelt, and you're looking out of the aircraft, and you're almost looking straight down. That's how rapidly he turned that thing sideways. We also saw General Westmoreland in one of these fire support bases.
I was going to ask you about that. What were the circumstances about around that?
Just pure luck. That was the second time I saw him. The first time was down at Hung Tam, and he came in for an inspection. Of course, everybody knew that. This one here was, we were at a fire support base, and the fire support base was, there was a continuous circling of I presume gunships, and one helicopter sat down, came in, landed, and got General Westmoreland. Walked around the fire support base, talking to the men. I actually got a picture of him doing that, looking very, very prim and proper.
Right.
As you would expect. But never spoke to him or anything, but I was not far away. I mean, I was within yards of the of Westmoreland. The company commander, our new company commander, Captain Shustak, he was great. He was a lot different from some of my other company commanders that I have been with. He was very, very involved in the welfare of his men. It was the first company I was in where no officer ate until every man in the unit was served. You were at the back of the line. That was not always the case. The welfare of his people was paramount. And the men really respected him highly. Very,
yeah.
Very, very highly. In the base camp our base camp now was Bearcat, our home base. And in Bearcat, he somehow acquired enough wood and so forth to build a whole company recreation hall. And
I've seen pictures of this. Can you describe it for me?
It was beautiful. We have couple guys that were very good carpenters, and he obtained the wood for the flooring. It had vinyl chairs and things like that inside. The cold beer. It was so good that the higher ranking up at division level were actually seemed to be a little upset, as I understand it, because the there's old Charlie Company with a rec hall that's nicer than what they have up at division level. And I've heard that from Captain Shustak. But so what they did, and this again is word back from Captain Shustak, is that we let them use it on occasion. But it was beautiful. It looked like, I mean, the inside of it looked like you went into a nice little lounge restaurant back in the States.
Hmm.
And the guys, at the end of the day, if you're in base camp, you know, when you've done your duties, you could go over there and relax and, you know, it was cold beer and so forth like that. It was great. Good for morale, let me put it that way.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was the morale of the unit, or in this case, units in which you were involved. What was the morale, discipline like when you were there, 66-67?
66-67 is a different time frame than what comes later.
Mm-hmm.
There were no drugs. Matter of fact, I'll be honest with you, I had, at that point in life, I didn't really know even what drugs were. We had none of that. We had very, very few disciplinary problems. And there's one problem, one incident that stands out in my mind. And this is how Captain Shustak worked it out. That we had some African-American members of our unit. I hope I'm doing this politically correct. And, of course, in a unit like this, we have people from various parts of the country. And on one occasion, apparently, and I'm doing this by hearsay because I know something happened. I know pretty well what happened. But I was not involved. That apparently two fellows took shaving cream and so forth and messed up a black fellow's living area.
Hmm.
And as I understood it, the captain went to the first sergeant and said, I won't be here for a while. When I come back, I want to know who did it. And he left. And the first sergeant was able to identify the men that did that, and they were gone immediately.
Hmm.
And I understand they went to the infantry.
So this was a racially based incident?
Yep.
Hmm.
That was the only thing I ever remember in any company that I ever served at, and that response was so quick that it made a hell of an impression on everybody. And there was nobody who thought that what was done was not the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Pretty tight-knit group then, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Charlie Company, both E Company and Charlie Company were tight-knit groups.
Yeah.
Our reunions are all, I mean, the guys come back, or come back with their wives and many times, and they just sit out there, and we have one session on every Saturday of our reunion. We have a reunion there every year. It's going to be our 12th one that's coming up this year, 12th and 13th. And we do a session we just call War Stories. And most of it's just about good times.
Mm-hmm.
Remember this, remember that, and you start to hear all these different stories. And, of course, we don't all overlap in time, so you hear what happened of times that were after us, 2 and 3 years after we had gone home. Because the unit still stayed.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most interesting was 2 years ago we did stories of the women at home.
Hmm.
And in some cases the ladies at home had it a lot worse than we did.
Sure.
Because of the feeling towards the soldiers and people being ostracized. In some cases classmates wouldn't talk to them because their husbands were serving in Vietnam. I'd never heard that because I'm a single guy. I didn't have any response to that.
Yeah.
My response was with my mom and dad at home and some letters back and forth with my my grandfather.
I know at one time you had another visitor or at least I saw a picture of another visitor. Pretty famous one, Jane Mansfield.
That was down, that was down in the Dong Tam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was relatively early when we were down there, before the base really built up to the size of the division headquarters, which it became. And we had heard that Jane Mansfield was coming in to visit us, which was really pretty awesome, to be honest with you. And when she came in, they had helicopters circling around, and I mean, it's hot and humid, it's miserable, and here's Jane Mansfield looking pretty good, looking real good. And the two of our guys over in the incoming inspection area, under the direction of Mr. Hukey, who was the warrant officer in charge, and I think I put that in there, that they built a, what we call the pink pot bra.
Yeah, can you describe what that is, or was?
It was two helmets, joined together, loosely joined together, to make a helmet bra, painted pink. And that she was presented with this pink pot bra, so she would, if there was an incident, that her vitals would be protected. And that made it news. That made news all the way back to the States. Because I heard about it from people back in the States, that about the pink pot bra. And to this day, I have a lot of respect for Jane Mansfield coming down to that location. Not a big base camp at that point. Out in the middle of, very, very hazardous area, let me put it that way. And certainly not a very pleasant place in terms of environment to come and visit the troops.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was great. Just by being there.
What other forms of entertainment did you get to enjoy, if any?
A lot of card games.
Mm-hmm.
At nighttime, of course, you went blackout for most of the time. Even in base camp, down whether it was up in where we were out in the field up with Charlie Company, or down in Dock Tam. All the flaps on the tents and everything went down. The generators were turned off at a certain time. So you had some lights until the generators went down. And we had a couple guys that were good on guitars, make your own music. Just sing. A lot of guys played cards. Within the troops and so forth, we had a volleyball net set up. We had boxing, controlled, so you don't lose anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, that was pretty much. We traded for with the Navy for stakes. We had the welding capabilities. We made things for them, and traded things that we made for them for steaks and so forth.
How was the food overall?
I'm not a gourmet cook, and I'm not a gourmet eater. So, from my viewpoint, if I wasn't hungry, I was happy.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that you might find people that might not agree with that. When we're out in the field, especially in Charlie Company, it was mostly canned rations, what they call C rations or stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah. So when we were on operations up in Charlie Company, and there's a number of them later on in my booklet, that a lot of times you just heat things on the manifold of the truck.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned those operations. Do you care to discuss any of them? Any of them come to mind?
I'll discuss one. Called Operation Paddington.
Right.
And I was separated from the main company by directive with a smaller force that had the capability to do just about everything that the company could do, but on a much lesser scale. And we convoyed up place was called near Zwan Lock. I remember being escorted. There was, in some cases, there were tanks on either side of the road, and then we set up in a in what was the base camp of the 11th Cav, which, as I understood it, was under the command of General George Patton's son. And it was during the monsoon season. It was absolutely miserable. The rain came down so hard that it would actually come filter through the tent. And we had just taken over some tents that were used, that were vacant inside their perimeter, and supported operations in the area. The guys that did tremendous, a lot of times working almost out in the open with maybe just strung up a tarp over them. We were able to support not only the people that we were supposed to support, but other units heard about good old Charlie Company, and in some cases brought things to us that we weren't required to support, but we did. And we had a great reputation. Hey, Charlie Company, those guys can do things. And I remember, I think I wrote this up, that with one unit that I traded, if they could get, they needed a power pack, which is a engine transmission unit for a 113. And I had some. I had actually some extras. Don't ask me how. I just had some extras. And so I traded an engine transmission power pack for if they could get me hot food. And they brought in hot food on a helicopter. So, it was one of those things that happened. The other thing that happened up there, two things I remember specifically, was in our shop office, which was a 2.5-ton truck with a large cab on it, that we had a reel-to-reel tape deck in there. And we would act as a clearinghouse for guys coming in and trade reel-to-reel tapes back and forth. So, I don't know where I was, but one day I came back to the shop office, and the two clerks that were in there was Spec 5 Medley and O'Connell from Texas, Lubbock, Texas, and there was a fellow Medley from someplace in San Francisco, I think from San Francisco, but anyway, he was from California. And the two guys are smiling like Cheshire cats. And kind of laughing, of course I wanted to be part of the, what's going on here, tell me the joke, figuring that, it's a joke, they're laughing at a joke. And all I could hear was, Lieutenant, you won't believe this, And I said, I won't believe what? And take a long story short, what they had done, and of course I had radios, that I could communicate with my unit back at in base camp. I also had other radios that I can listen to links on other, areas. And what they did is, I guess you've probably heard this before. Our theme song was "We Got to Get Out of This Place."
Mm-hmm.
Well, damn if they didn't turn on, it was the battalion net. They turned on the battalion net and played part of that over the battalion net. And my son, I said, "You did what?" I said, "How could you do that?" Well, we thought it'd be funny. I guess in hindsight, I did too, but, common sense is common sense. Oh, shit. I said, my ass is grass. Christ, I only got 6 weeks and I'm going home. Oh, Christ, I'm going to get court-martialed. So, lo and behold, the radio call came in and Captain Shustak's coming up. And I said, well, my ass is really grass now. So,
within a short period of time, the helicopter landed. I'm not saying it was, you know, an hour's worth, the next day or whatever it was, but whatever it was, I was scared to crap. I said, I'd just blown everything. And Captain Shustak, I went over to the helipad. I met Captain Shustak. Of course, you immediately salute. And this is exactly how it was. He got off the helicopter, and he was a tall guy, 6 foot, about 6 foot one, two. And he put his arm around me, and I'm not a big guy. I'm 5'8" and a half. And all he said was, "Lieutenant, I suggest that that never happen again." End of story. And now how he got, he covered me. And after that, that was it. I suggest that never happened again. And then he went around and reviewed and met everybody out there. When I reunited with him many, many years later, when our unit started to coalesce as a veterans unit, finding people, I got a call one night from a fellow junior officer who was in South Dakota. And he called me up, and of course, his name is Bob Gregoire. I said, "Bob, my God, how'd you find me?" He said, "Well, through Dean Ayers, part of the fellow that's found so many of these people." And we talked and so forth. "What have you been doing, routine?" And then he says, "Hey, our company commander lives down in your area. He lives in Pennsylvania." And my response was, "Hey, Bob, Pennsylvania's a big state." And he says, "Well, some place called Wyomissing." And I said, "Wyomissing? My God, that's only 60 miles from me." And Captain Shustak had retired just 60 miles away from where I am right now. And we're still, we still are. That's where he and his wife chose to retire after full 24 years of service, I think it was. Full bird colonel.
Hmm. How about that?
So we made arrangements. I called him up, and this is how the phone call went. Bob Gregoire gave me Captain Shustak's number. And so I called him up, and he answered the phone. And the way I addressed him was, I said, "Captain Shustak, this is Raccoon Charlie 5-5, which is my call sign. Raccoon is our company. Raccoon is the battalion. Charlie is the company. 5-5 is the executive officer." And there was a minute of silence, and he said, "Lieutenant DeLong, is that you?" And that's the way it, and to this day, we met, and it's funny, with my, with Captain Shustak, he's still Captain Shustak.
Yeah.
To me, I can't call him Frank. My wife, she calls him Captain. I still call him Captain. That's just going to always be that way. He'll always be the captain.
Yeah, some relationships that never changes even through the years.
Never change. Hmm. Our reunions with the senior officers, our former battalion commanders and all, which were some great guys. But gotten to know these gentlemen as human beings out of the environment that we were in, and listen to them and their stories, from a different perspective of us guys out in the field, and how much they respected the men and so forth that served up for them. Pretty awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty awesome. Great group of guys. And incidentally, in our reunion, the fellows that we have found have all done well. There's no losers. There's not one, I shouldn't maybe use that word loser, because if that's an indicator, if I'm using that detrimentally, I don't mean to. That all the guys that we have found, and we found several hundred that have served in our unit, not all of them want to be involved in the veterans organization, but they're top-notch. In whatever fields they have gone into, they're top-notch guys. So good guys in the field over there turned out to be good guys when they came home.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that just briefly here. Usually it's something I might bring up toward the end of the interview, but you brought up the topic of the reunions and the association and getting to know these people and reacquainting yourself with them. What is the importance to you for these, or for this reunion organization that you have?
The getting to know and reacquaint with the fellows that you serve with has been so rewarding. Just the camaraderie. What have they done with their lives? You know, their children, their marriages, and not everybody is 100% successful in marriage. I won't say that by any means. But for the most part, they are. It's just so fun to come back and just, you know, rehash those old times. It's like a fraternity reunion in a certain way, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
We were there. None of us wanted to be there. At least none that I know of, anyhow. You were asked to do a job. It was your duty, and you did it. And you did it with pride. You did it with a great bunch of people. And you come back 20 years. No, it's more than that. It's almost 50 years, 50-plus years now. It's been a wonderful opportunity to reunite. And we've now done, and I'm the treasurer. So I get to go to every one, because somebody's got to pay the bills.
Right.
And the one thing I will say, that when we formed up an organization, and I was asked to be the treasurer, I took that with a, wow, what a vote of confidence for these gentlemen to give me that responsibility to handle the funds. And of course, there's an oversight. We have an organization. Excuse me. But I took that as a great vote of confidence that the that both the officers and the men would say, you know, Lieutenant DeLong, we entrust you with the funds for this organization.
Yeah, sure.
And the one thing about that job is there's only one way out. Because we reelect the officers every year, and all you hear is, doing a great job. Keep it up. Somebody else want to do this? Oh, no, you're doing a great job.
Yeah, you're stuck.
You're stuck. One way out of this job. And I have actually made arrangements for that. Just, you know, and what I did is I put it in my final directives, my will, that if something happened to me, that the funds in the organization are included in there, and who to contact and so forth. If, you know, if I had an accident tomorrow or something happened where I couldn't do it, that the lawyer and the legal firm that would handle our estate would be, you know where this is, who it is, who's on the sign-up cards and so forth, that it would not be lost to the union.
Right. Sure.
It's all taken care of. Did that, you know, as on my own as a way if something happened to me.
That's good thinking. Let me take you back to Vietnam, Jack, and kind of winding down your tour. One thing we haven't talked about is an R&R leave. Did you get to take an R&R?
Yep.
Where'd you go?
Went to Japan. And remember I mentioned sometime when we first started this thing that one time my mom turned around to me and pointed her finger at me and said, I always expect you to behave as my son.
Right.
Well, yeah, I was on a plane and went up to Japan. We got off, and I hooked up with two guys that were helicopter pilots. And we started, I'm just a third wheel here, and following these guys. And they were out for things that Mom wouldn't appreciate,
mm-hmm.
if you want to look at it that way. And about 4 o'clock in the morning, had an opportunity to do some things that Mom wouldn't appreciate. And I couldn't get that directive out of my head.
Oh, really?
And so I said, I've got whatever it was, 5 days here, and I can do things that I might regret for the rest of my life, or I can take the opportunity to see what I can see. And so I left those two guys. I had my little bag, and I went up to there was a place where you could military place where you could have a room and so forth for a nominal cost. And then for the next 4 or 5 days that I was there, I explored Japan. And this, I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I got to go where I went, because I don't understand the language. And when you get out of the main downtown like Tokyo, the signs are not in English. And somehow I did it. Went to, you know, just different historical sites, Kamakura Buddha and other things that just, you know, I made it there. And went downtown to downtown Tokyo, went into theaters. They were topless theaters, but they were pretty good. And, you know, Japan's a little different than moral codes than what we have here in terms of what's acceptable and non-acceptable.
Sure.
And that was perfectly acceptable. And I ate the Japanese food lots of times just by pointing. A lot of Japanese places, like, they'll have what they serve outside as a display.
Mm-hmm.
And I would just point to it. And I saw as much as I could. I did have the opportunity way back in the 80s on business to go back to Japan on a number of occasions, and this time was a lot different in terms of, you know, being picked up at the airport and chauffeured here and so forth like that. And then I wondered, geez, how the hell did I get around this country?
Young enough not to care, I guess.
It was mind-boggling to me that all these places I went to, and somehow I got there and got back, and without having, I guess you're different when you're that age.
Yeah.
But Japan was great. I had a great time. I've been back a number of times since then, all in business, and have some, still to this day, some, even though I'm long retired, still correspond with some of the Japanese business associates that I had in the 1980s.
Let's take a quick break there, Jack. Okay, so it sounds like you had a pretty good R&R. How much time left in country did you have when you took your R&R?
If I remember right, I still had several months left after I came back from R&R.
Oh, okay.
And was actually offered another one by the company commander, and I turned it down because there was a field operation going on. I didn't want my guys going out, and I wouldn't be with them. I would have never been able to carry that burden if something happened.
Hmm.
So I turned down that opportunity and stayed with the company.
Interesting. Do you recall what the operation was, or what it was about?
Yeah, that was Operation Paddington.
And I'm Paddington.
That was the one that where we were up by the up by the Swan Lock with the 11th Cap.
Yeah. Interesting. What other sort of things come to mind when you think about your tour there?
Heat. When we first went in country, it was we had left during the winter time, and it took a while to get acclimated. The mosquitoes, just the dampness, humidity. Adjust everything, but certainly wasn't comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
The monsoon season, the incessant rain, muck, mud. If you look in my little booklet there, you'll see a picture of the officer's tent at Bearcat, and it's a tent in the middle of a lake.
Yeah.
working in the rain. And then at the end of the monsoon season, you get the opposite. And it's very, very dry, and certainly for us, very, very dusty. Dust blowing like dust clouds.
Mm-hmm.
They would water down the roads and so forth. The dust just blew incessantly. It was in everything. But you're young. It's the way it is. It's, you know, that's how I look at it. It's the way it is.
Right.
Nothing I can do to change it.
I spent some time looking through the photographs on your association's website from a variety of different people. That's the way it looked, like it was choked with mud or it was incredibly dry and wasn't much in between. That's what it looked like.
That's about what it is. That's about the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
In the some of the operations, you were constantly, you know, wet, and the muck and so forth. Up in the Swan Lock, when we lined up to come back, that there was this red clay and raining like crazy. But to drive the Jeep down the road, these are dirt roads, you actually had to crab it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Explain that if you would, though, please.
Yeah, pointed, and you're not pointing straight down the road. You're pointing at an angle up the road to go straight down the road. And one part actually stopped, and the thing started to slide off the road just because of the camber.
Hmm.
Also got lost on the way back. I think I mentioned that. And I was the lead of my segment, and had the map. And somehow, at one point, I missed the turn and ended up completely out in the bush by myself and the driver, spec 4 medley. And all I can say is, hand to God, I have no idea to this day how I got back in the convoy.
Hmm.
We were going down roads and through villages and so forth like that, just a lieutenant with an M16 and his faithful 45, a radio, and having no idea. And somehow I found my way back. And I just think it, you know, I think it was a greater hand. It wasn't me.
Hmm.
It just happened.
You talked about the weather. What kind of effect does this have on the work that you're doing?
Makes it harder. That's obvious.
How so?
But, I mean, just the heat, humidity, the rain. But you did what you had to do. That's the only way things got done. I don't want to crow too much, but I think Old Charlie Company had probably one of the lowest deadline rates of any unit that I know of, because we were so good at what we did. We had units that we did not support that would come over, you know. let me put it this way, you know. I own a Buick, but I don't like their service. I'll go down here to the Chevrolet dealer because they can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was that happened. If you use that scenario.
Yeah.
And the guys, if we could help, and it started right from the NCOs on down, if we could help, we did.
Well, that's got to instill a lot of pride in them. A
lot of pride.
As well.
And that's evident when we have our reunions. There's a lot of pride in these guys.
Mm-hmm. So when do you come home? It's October or
yep.
November? October of 67?
October 67. At that point, I was wearing a couple hats. The company commander had been promoted. And so he was serving less time with the unit, so I was actually serving as a shop officer, sometimes jointly as shop officer, company commander.
Hmm.
Not a bad deal because of the sergeant. And we also were going through a CMI inspection, command maintenance management inspection. which we had to prepare for.
Yeah, that's no small thing. Can you describe that for me?
They come down and they go through all your operations, the whole company, looking at how well you do things, how you do things, and how well you don't. Excuse me. Getting the horse through. And we did very well.
How would you prepare for that, and what are they looking for? How does that inspection process work?
Go through all of your operational procedures. Look at your deadline. Parts ordering. Everything you're supposed to do, they will come down. Excuse me. And go through the whole operation of the company. And then give you a rating on how well you're doing. Had to hide a lot of stuff.
Is that right?
Had to hide Charlie 51, my Jeep. had to hide our extra things that we had that we weren't supposed to have.
Right, not on the TONE, and you shouldn't have
them. They weren't on the TONE. And we didn't have a problem with that because the units we supported were more than glad to help us out.
I bet so. What other sort of things might you have had that you were not officially supposed to have?
Too many engine assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
Too many spare parts. And I read your release that I signed. But there was one thing that that oftentimes we did is that if you took a vehicle that we had to evacuate back to a higher level of support, you weren't supposed to take anything off of that that was usable. You were supposed to send it back as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to admit that we may not have adhered to that to the letter of the law.
I would, I'd be surprised if it were otherwise.
So, I might put something on it, but if it was good, we just might be able to keep it.
Right.
That
well,
I had it.
And that's one of the reasons why you can be more effective, is if you manage to corral a lot of these spare parts that you wouldn't normally have.
That we didn't, weren't authorized to keep.
Yeah.
Let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm. Sure. As your tour's winding down there, you're a short-timer, but you're also, an officer. You are, de facto company commander. What is your, how does your job, how does your lifestyle change as a company commander, acting in place of the company commander?
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
The first sergeant pretty well took over the responsibilities of the all the paperwork and everything like that. So I can still consider to run the shop operations and then just sign off on the paperwork as a sergeant preparator.
Mm-hmm.
We were short personnel and just did what you had to do. It worked, it was no detriment, let me put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't out in the field either, so it was a base camp operation at that time, so it would be different if we were out in the field and separated like I was before, but I was not.
Yeah. Well, as your time is running short, what are your plans for the future? What do you want to do once you get back from Vietnam?
You know, I've heard of so many stories of guys coming home and what it's like. I'll give you mine. I'm starting to run out of the bow. Excuse me. It was only about 36 hours from the time I left my company. Went down to Long Bend. We went down by bus. And turned in your stuff. You had a small duffel bag. Come home with. Summer uniform. Short sleeves. And we flew from Tonsonut to Okinawa. Okinawa back to San Francisco. Got off the plane, immediately out processed, and you're out in the street. and I got a taxi to the San Francisco airport. Payphone, called home and said, you know, I got in a military standby seat and got on the plane and came into Philadelphia. It was October. It was cold. Cold compared to what I was used to. And I got off the plane, and Mom and Dad were there. And this I'll never forget to my dying day. Of course, I, you know, hugged my mom. And Dad and I more or less, you know, shook hands. You know, father and son was, and our relationship wasn't, you know, it was a father-son relationship. And his words were made were the following. Well, son, you've done your duty. Now get on with your life. That was a World War II Normandy veteran, and that was his attitude, and that's what was given to me. You've done your duty. Now get on with your life. And I took 5 days off. And felt guilty as hell because I wasn't doing anything. I was doing stuff, but, you know, Mom and Dad were working, people were going to work, and I wasn't. And so I took 5 days off, 5 working days off, and I went back to work and never turned back. Kind of just, you know, it was out of my mind for a long time, completely.
So what did you want to do once you got back home? Do you still have more time in the Army?
I had, you know, my reserves, but as a veteran of serving in Vietnam, they never called up. They promoted me to captain. I got a letter that I was promoted to captain, but they didn't call and I didn't ask. So I put my, you know, I put my time in, but it was in active reserves. And I just went on with my life.
Well, what's the next step for you then?
Well, first thing I did, bought another race car. Well, I bought another car and turned it into a race car. And I had my job back, which was a great job. It was a grooming job within the corporation. And things were great. And had a, you know, built another race car. I had great people in my crew. The fellow that was my biggest mentor went on to work for Roger Penske. And you've probably heard of Roger Penske.
Sure.
He at one point was the prepared all Roger Penske's IROC, American Road Racing Champion Series cars. He was the Gary Bettenhausen Indianapolis 500 crew chief for Roger Penske. So I had some good people. Was able to associate with some very good people. Had a very, very competitive car. And one day I was going through the, I was laboratory manager of incoming inspection. And I heard two fellows talking about a girl that was at a company picnic. I wasn't there, but they were talking about this girl at a company picnic. And I stopped, and people don't believe us, but it's honest to God truth. And I said, in my mind, I said, I have got to meet that girl because I'm going to marry her. And one fellow's name was Phil Higgins. And I said, Phil, you know, how can I meet this girl? And she was friends with Phil's wife. And so I bugged him a few times, and finally, you know, what's going on? Why won't she reciprocate in any form at all? And Phil said, well, she doesn't go out on blind dates. And I'm sitting there, you know, and Kelly, don't put me on a pedestal, but I'm sitting there, Jesus, I got a race car, I got a motorcycle, I got a little jingle in my pocket, and she won't even give me she won't even answer a phone. And, well, that's more of a challenge, really. So what they finally did is they finally made arrangements where there was a company's mixed league softball league, that she would come to this, she would come to Phil's house, I would go to Phil's house, and then we would go together, and would be all within, you know, a lot of people around. No blind dates or anything like that, you're just going to meet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did. I show up on my motorcycle. Yeah, first thing, she doesn't ride the motorcycle. So let me put it that way. We started off, you know, and we're still together. We'll have our 50th coming up next year.
And what is her name?
Her name's Doris. Doris, she's Irish. Her mom's Irish. Her dad's Irish. And I had not a clue. I knew Ireland was over there, but my God, I've sure been indoctrinated into the Irish community. And we've been married, and we've had a wonderful life together.
Yeah, outstanding.
And I'm not saying that, but it has been a wonderful life. I couldn't ask for better. That's not going to work.
Did you keep up with the war once you got back?
No.
Just got on with your life like your father advised.
It's going on with your life. And what he was saying is, as an engineering graduate, that the engineering turnover in terms of knowledge is so rapid that it's, the longer you stay out of it, the more obsolete you become.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was overseas, he would send me my engineering magazine. Well, you know what I did with them. But that was that. And so you better get back in the boat and start, you know, reacclimating to your professional career, because if you're out of it much longer, you're not going to be of much value to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And he was absolutely right. And I did have a very, very good career, engineering career.
Well, just a couple more questions for you, Jack. Kind of broad and general questions that I like to ask. Looking back on the Vietnam War, your experiences in Vietnam, how do you think you were most affected by your time there?
As an individual, and I kind of look at it as, this was the transition from a kid to an adult. That when I went into the service, I was still, in a lot of cases, a little juvenile. I was a good guy, I'm not saying that, but I didn't have the directive, the focus that I had 2 years later when I came out. When I came back to work, I was a different person than the guy that went in.
How so?
Wanted to be successful. Wanted to get ahead. Wanted to be good at what I do. This idea of being number one, of whether, like the companies I were in, we all had this motivation to be good. And I was lucky enough in my engineering career, for the most part, to be always in a managerial position, and every one of the organizations, or you know, whatever section I was in, that we were always number one. I don't know, it was just something that, you know, you just want to be good, just like you're Villanova, you want to be good, you want to be number one. And as a laboratory manager, that worked out. It was worked out at Standard Press Steel. It worked out when I went to into the utility industry. And when I finally left that, our laboratory, our engineering laboratory, materials engineering laboratory, was known as probably one of the best utility laboratories in the country, if not in the world. And everybody had that attitude. Always had the opportunity to work with great people. Whether that just worked out or not, but it's some cases they didn't, and they didn't last. But they've all gone to very successful careers, and I feel real proud of that. The people who worked for me, or worked under me, were all very successful in their own right, and have gone on to great success after I've been gone.
Last question for you. Looking at the Vietnam War from your perspective 50-some-odd years later, as we try to determine the meaning of the Vietnam War as American society, you were there. What do you think is the meaning of the Vietnam War? What do you take away from it?
On a larger perspective, I look at the Vietnam War as part of the Cold War. There were hot spots in the Cold War. There were cold spots. Korea's a hot spot. Vietnam's a hot spot. Vietnam served as a buffer for communist expansion down through the Malaysian Peninsula into the Philippines. So there's a larger picture. I don't think it was fought the right way at all.
How do you think it should have been approached?
I think we should have been integrated with the South Vietnamese to a much higher extent. Not, you know, here comes the GIs, we're going to do it our way. And they're kind of somebody else. We didn't really integrate at all with the, in my experience, except, and I had more than most. We didn't integrate with their culture. We didn't integrate with their people. And, I feel that was a big loss. The other loss was that for most of us, all we, you know, we had a 1 month or a 1 year term, and we're out of there. So by the time you really get to being pretty good at what you're doing, oftentimes you're leaving, and then a new guy would come in that doesn't have a clue. Now it happened with a fellow that came in and took my place. He was in OCS and had gone, you know, go through OCS, Officer Candidate School, and then he comes in, and I just watched him for, you know, the last 5 or 6 days I was there, and you know, you can't do it that way. You can't operate that way. These people are, you know, they know more than you do, and you better respect them. But that was my feeling. The other feeling is often, you know, on a higher perspective is, just a junior officer. I did what I was asked to do. Hopefully did it to a high level of what would be, you know, required of me. And it's the leaders of the country to determine where we're going. I don't make those policies. As my dad said, you've done your duty, now get on with your life.
Yeah.
I did lose friends that I still think of almost every day. I lost my college roommate. I lost two fraternity brothers, and it was of my class. And about half of us served in Vietnam. Of our, you know, of my fraternity class, like class of 64. One was killed in the first air cab, and Dick was killed in the first air cab, and Freddie was killed in the first division. Recon platoon leader, and he wouldn't let his men go out at the end of his term. He was ready to come home. He was killed, hostile fire. I'll never forget them. Not only never forgot them, there's a mural under the hood of one of my cars that's dedicated to him.
Jack, is there anything else you'd like to add before we bring it to a close?
Kelly, I'd just like to say thanks for listening.
It's been my pleasure.
Really?
Okay, Jack, pick back up there real quick.
During the course of our conversations, especially growing up, I mentioned that on the 50th anniversary of D-Day, I'd gone down to Mom and Dad's house and sat down with my dad. had breakfast, and thought that maybe I could get him to open up a little bit on his military experience, his time, which he never would. He never talked to any appreciable extent. And so I actually approached him. We were sitting in the, after Mom served breakfast, and we were sitting in the living room, and I asked him. He gave a few little tidbits. The one of one was about, he talked about the shelling, and his mind shut down on that very quickly. And then he talked about being in an observation aircraft, and they couldn't get back to their lines, and they had to either ditch in the ocean or try to land on this little airport. Well, they did land on the airport, because ditching in the ocean would have been would have been death. And then that was it. And then he told me the following story. He said, when I got my orders to go to Vietnam, he had written to the Department of Defense and asked to go in my place. But he was turned down. I get a little bit emotional. But he wanted to go in my place so I could have my life.
That's incredible.
And that was it. He got up and walked out. Never heard, told me once, that was it. But that's a father's love for his son.
Isn't that something?
So I guess that's the end of the story.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Jack. I would hate to have not had that on the recording.
True story.